Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies titled In the European Night, Will the Union Survive? Our speaker is media activist and philosopher Franco Bifo Berardi. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Wellesley College Assistant Professor of Cinema and Media Studies, Nicholas Knuth.
It is my honor and privilege to be here tonight and share the stage and introduce Franco Bifo Berardi, one of the most thought-provoking theorists and practitioners of media and political thought today. I teach at Wellesley in the Cinema and Media Studies program and an assistant professor there. And so I came to Berardi's work through his experiments and writings about media. When I was beginning my dissertation research and writing an article on the activities of a group called Hackitectura from Spain, they were trying to create one of the first wireless data transmissions across the Straits of Gibraltar between Spain and Morocco. I was thinking of how to theorize this work and, of course, turn to Deleuze and Guattari. And while reading Guattari's work, I came across the descriptions and histories of this project called Radio Alice, Berardi was involved with very extensively in Bologna in the late 1970s. And so what drew me most prominently to Berardi's work and Radio Alice in particular was the attention to the power of what we could call the boundaries or limits of language, of signs, of semiotics. When Félix Guattari was writing about Radio Alice, he wrote, quote, "On Italian free radio, it often happens that very serious debates are directly interrupted by violently contradictory, humorous, or even poetico-delirious interventions," end quote. The violent shutdown of Radio Alice and the generalized crackdown on protest movements in Italy at the time did not stop Berardi from continuing his work in media, as he did with the telestreet phenomenon of micro-television stations that broadcast to small localized regions, begun in Bologna, as well as online projects such as recombinant.org. So I see Berardi's more recent writings as those of a nuanced, complex, and timely thinker who is always informed by the machinations of media practice. For my own writings and artistic projects, I've drawn to Berardi's ideas of how noise, impurity, the limits, the boundaries, the poetic, desire, can disrupt semiocapitalism and the financialization of language. In The Uprising on Poetry and Finance, Berardi writes of the need for paresia, or fearless speech, to counter contemporary cynicism, and he explores in that book how poetry and art might just be able to be used against capitalism, and I would argue act as forms of paresia as well. I just want to quote a bit from this book, The Uprising, that I think hopefully we can turn to a little bit during the discussion today, namely the power of the ways in which poetry and art and media can counter some of the microfascisms and semiocapitalism more generally. He writes, quote, "In the current conditions of capitalist competition, acceleration is the trigger for panic, and panic is the premise to depression. Singularity is forgotten, erased, and canceled in the erotic domain of semiocapitalism. The singularity of the voice and the singularity of words are subjected to the homogenization of exchange and valorization," end quote. But he writes a bit later that poetry, quote, "is the singular vibration of the voice. This vibration can create resonances, and resonances can produce common space," end quote. I thus see Berardi as a manifestly hopeful thinker and activist, someone for whom the power of poetry, of art, of desire, has the potential to disrupt microfascisms and semiocapital alike. Berardi's title today is In the European Night, Will the Union Survive? Please join me in welcoming Franco Bifo Berardi.
Thank you, Nick. And sometimes in life and in history too, we have to think with two different brains, if I may say so. One has to be the realistic brain, the brain that is focused on the likely future, the probable future. The other brain is the brain that is dedicated to the the imagination of the possible. And to distinguish these two different levels is important at the theoretical level and also at the existential level in order to avoid despair, depression sometimes. And particularly it's important because we should not mistake reality and the probability, the probable future, with the entire, with the whole spectrum of possibility. The possible is much more wide than the probable. I would say that actually future does not exist. And we should replace the concept of future with the concept of futurability, different layers of possibilities. I say that in this moment because if we realistically look at the next decade, we risk to be lost, to get lost, to have the impression that nothing can be done. Actually, some of the trends, of the tendencies that are inscribed in the present situation of the world, and particularly of Europe, seem to be unstoppable, in a sense. And the possibility of reverting the present condition, of escaping the present condition, has to be found starting from the consciousness that what is happening, what is probably going to happen tomorrow, is not the entire spectrum of the possibility. I will try now to speak about the probability, what we see. But at the end, I will try to look at this fissure, at this discrepancy, not exactly a contradiction, much more an asymmetry that gives us the possibility of imagining something that is apparently totally realistic. Nothing to do with the utopia. I don't like the word utopia. It's a sort of trap. I prefer to think of possibilities inscribed in the present that we are unable to see at the present. Stop with the philosophy. Let's start to talk about the present. The former president of the European Commission, whose name is Romano Prodi, said the following words, quote, "I am not resigned, but I am obliged to certify a progressive weakening of the European Union, not only because of the Brexit, but because of the lack of any common sentiment and of any common policy." And simultaneously, more or less in the same hour, in the city of Calais, François Hollande, the president of the French Republic, said, "We are going to totally dismantle the jungle. We don't want that France may become a territory of refugees." When I read this word, I have been a refugee in France for 2 years. And I remember that when I was there, my friends were refugees from the fascist Spain, from many countries of Africa, of South America, and so on. So reading those words of the irresponsible and, frankly speaking, ignorant president of the French Republic gave me a sort of bad effect. In a lovely country called Switzerland, there was a referendum. And the referendum was about the workers, the migrant workers coming from Italy. Not exactly from Italy, particularly from Lombardia, a northern region which is led by a racist party called the Northern League. Well, as you know, every north is the south of somebody else. The Swiss decided that the Lombardi cannot come to work in Switzerland. And guess what was the slogan of the right wing fighting against the Italian workers? Switzerland first, of course. Everybody is first, but this is, starts to become a problem. Well, three events, three significant events in the same day. I would say that the clues are an evidence. The evidence that dark has fallen in Europe. Let's try to understand what's happening in Europe. Because the evidence is that the European Union is a non-existing thing. I mean, after the massive wave of migration from Northern Africa and the Middle East, you know that the reaction of some of the European countries, namely Hungary, Poland, and some other eastern countries of Europe, that reaction has been totally breaking the very idea of union. Italy and Greece are overwhelmed by the migration wave, but the Hungarian and the Polish don't want to deal with the problem. Well, don't forget that 2 million Polish are working as migrants in the United Kingdom, in the Midlands particularly. And as you know, the British have decided that they are no more union. Oh, I understand. And they are no more European. So all of a sudden, Polish people are saying no to the Syrians, and the Midlanders of the United Kingdom are demonstrating in the streets against the Polish workers, because what are you doing here? This is no more Europe. So go back to Poland. This is enough, I think, to understand why we can say that the European Union is a dead man walking, zombie that is unable to decide about the most important things. Some important things are decided. For instance, remember in July 2015, 5 July 2015, the Greek people go to vote for a referendum about yes or not accepting the diktat of the Troika. 62% of the Greek voters said, no, we cannot accept a more devastation of our economy, of our society, of our daily life. We cannot accept the humiliation of imposed by the Troika. What has happened next, the following days? 5 days after, Tsipras is obliged to go to Brussels to take out his jacket threw the jacket on the table of the discussion. He said, do you want also these? The Greek government has been obliged to accept the humiliation and the economic devastation that in the polls they had rejected. In that case, the union has been working. Matteo Renzi, the Italian young premier who these days is screaming that he needs, Italy needs more flexibility, 1 year ago was not so flexible about the Greeks. He was part of the unified European decision of not respecting the decision of the majority of the Greeks. So, when I say the European Union does not exist, I must say something more. The European Union does not exist except when it comes to paying the debt, except when it comes to rescue the banks, the bank system. That is the situation. But let's try, how have we got at this point? What has happened before? I don't want to remount to 60 years ago. I don't want to remount to the Maastricht Treaty. Just I want to make a fast remind about the recent transformation of the Union. I start from the year 2005. In the year 2005, a constitutional transformation has been proposed, which was essentially aimed to the so-called liberalization of the labor market. Liberalization of the labor market means the average salary of a Polish worker is 500 euros, the average salary of a French worker is 1,500 euros. A liberalization of the job of the labor market would have implied a general reduction of the salary in Europe, which is happening. I mean, we can say that in the last 20 years, my salary, I speak about myself, my salary has been more or less halved. It has been halved in the passage from the Italian lira to the euro. My salary was 2 million lire at the end of the 90s, and the year after it has become 1,000 euros, because officially 1 euro equals 2,000 lire. Actually, 1,000 euros buys as much as 1 million lire, not 2 million. So actually, for the southern countries of Europe, the shift from national currency to the European currency has translated into a general reduction of the average salary. This is not true for the German workers, for instance, but it's certainly true for the Spanish, the Greeks, the Italians, the French too. What happens in 2005? When this constitutional transformation is proposed, in France and Holland, many social organizations propose a referendum against this transformation. At that point, the refusal of the financial aggression against the salary of the people, this referendum, this refusal, has been backed by the National Front. in France, and has been not backed by the left. By the left, I mean by the Socialist Party, by Daniel Cohn-Bendit, and also by Tony Negri. Tony Negri and Daniel Cohn-Bendit said, and I must confess that I agreed with them. We said, if we say no to this constitutional transformation, we are breaking the union. We are provoking an effect of renationalization of the politics of France, of Holland, then of all the other countries. It has been probably the most serious mistake of my personal political life. I was not really persuaded. I was, if I was a French citizen and if I had to vote, probably I would have refused, would have abstained. But anyway, in the political forum, we said yes to the constitutional transformation because it's the only way to maintain a level of political union at the European level. You know what is the effect of our decision in that moment? That the National Front in France is now the only political representation of the workers of, for instance, the northern area of France. The National Front has become and is the force that politically represents the workers' refusal of the financial blackmail, of the financial plundering. That is the reason why the National Front is going to be, is already the first party in France, and is going to be the party that will contend the presidency of the Republic to what? What will happen next year at the election for the presidency in France? Well, you will have two parties fighting for the presidency. One party is Marine Le Pen, the National Front. The other party is Sarkozy, or in the best of the hypotheses, Alain Juppé. I mean, the fascist nationalist right against the fascist neoliberal right of Sarkozy. This is the scenario in France at this moment. As for François Hollande, is quote is how do you say is predicted to have around 17-18% of the votes. The left has disappeared in Europe. This is the other important thing that we have to understand. And in a sense, it has disappeared not only because of our decision in 2005 to vote for the union against the workers. That has been an horrible mistake, but because this has been the general line, the general choice, the general political choice of the left during the last 15 years. What is the effect of the financial devastation of the union? It's easy to understand if you have a look at the figures. The Italian industrial product is not the product, the industrial apparatus, the industrial infrastructure has gone down, has decreased of 22% in the last 15 years. The Spanish is down of 24% The Greek, I don't know. If you go to Athens, you can perceive, walking in the streets, what has been the effect of the financial devastation. The effect is that suicide is skyrocketing among young people, that heroin is everywhere in the center of the city, then every month more and more locals and shops and business are closing in the cities, and the sense of humiliation is leading the Greek people to refuse any kind of political demonstration, except at the extreme right and at the extreme left, where some explosion happen time by time. Unemployment is rising everywhere. And do not trust in the voices that say, oh yes, but in the last 6 months in Italy, unemployment is going down. No, it's not true. It's what is true is that the regular jobs have gone down in the last year. The new regular jobs have gone down of 36%, while the precarious jobs, no, pardon me, of 34%, while the precarious jobs have gone up of 36%. So 36% more precarious workers, 34% less regular workers. That means that, yes, unemployment is going down, but precarization is taking the upper hand everywhere. That is the effect of the financial aggression against the society. In the year 2009-2011, in many European countries, like in the United States, like in many parts of the world, we had a sort of general uprising against the financial aggression. The effects of this uprising have been very, 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 very weak, actually, nothing. And this is the point. The political action is unable to transform anything at the level of finance. And democracy is totally ineffective at this level. The Greek example is crystal clear, but not only that. Why so? I would say that we are facing a new situation in which the reality, the concrete reality of life, of political engagement, of democracy, is unable to grasp the abstract sphere of governance, of the financial governance. The word governance is crucial at this level. What is the governance? Why we are using more and more the word governance, and we are more and more forgetting about the word government? Because government means the political will able to transform, to decide, to control reality. Governance has a totally different meaning, which is scarcely analyzed at the philosophical level. But if you read Niklas Luhmann, you understand. Niklas Luhmann explained that at a certain level of complexity, human will becomes unable to understand and to decide. So what can we do? We have to transfer the power of decision from democracy, from the political will, to the techno-linguistic automatisms that are constituting the financial machine. Mario Draghi, which is a smart guy and an ironic guy, after the Italian election of 3 years ago, while politicians and journalists were kind of excited because something is happening, Movimento 5 Stelle, the anti-European, the anti-financial are taking too many votes. And Mario Draghi at a press conference said, "Don't worry, guys. The European economy is governed by the autopilot. The concept of autopilot is the concept that explains what has been happening in the last 10, 15 years in Europe. But you know what? The autopilot is perfect when it comes to decide about the relation between finance and real economy. The real economy is totally submitted by the financial autopilot. The real economy is destroyed, displaced, dislocated, dismantled, restructured according to the financial autopilot. But something is happening at another level, which is the level of, I would say, of the social unconscious, a level which is not translated in a democratic way, in a rational way, in a political way, but is translated in the form of hate, rage. You know what I'm talking about. I mean, in the United States, we have the most impressive example of the social unconscious reacting against the black president on one side and the intolerable aggressiveness of the financial dictatorship on the other side. Fascism is the word to name what is becoming the majority of the European society. I say nothing about the American, I don't know. But certainly what has happened in the United Kingdom only 4 months ago is the proof of the fact that fascism has taken the upper hand. And when I say fascism, fascism is an old word. I know we should create new names, new expressions to define the problem. Probably it's not fascism and it's not Nazism. It's something that I prefer to call, not as Hitler said, national socialism, but more social nationalism. We have to stress the social origin of the new aggressive nationalism that is growing everywhere in Europe, except in Spain. We should understand why. Spain is a country where there is no national government in the last year, but they live very well. I mean, yeah, unemployment is around 43% among young people, but they don't care so much. Spain is the only place in Europe where people are smiling in the streets. I think that Spain is an interesting example of a sort of autonomization of a large part of society from the blackmail of the economy and from the blackmail of the national state. We don't need a national state anymore. That is what you perceive in the street of Barcelona, of Madrid, of Valencia, and so on, where political decision is taken by massive assemblies of people in the municipalities that are led by people like Maria Carmona or Ada Colau, who represent squatters, feminists, indignados, and and so on. Will it last? I don't know. Anyway, the general landscape is going towards a sort of general depression of the political, of the social life, and towards an effective, a real dismantlement of the European culture, of the European citizenship, of the European belonging, just to use a bad word, that what is left of Europe is the governance of the bank system. But it's not going to work for long, because the right wing, the racists, are going to win almost everywhere, especially in Northern Europe, in Eastern Europe, and so on. So I try to widen my field of attention. I try to go beyond the limits of the European collapse in order to understand what is happening in the long time, in the next decade and more. And I think that the problem that we should analyze is the relation between the present crisis and the worldwide economic slump that is underway. I want to say something about this point. Some months ago in the New York Times, I read an article by Clifford Krauss, who says that the flood of raw materials is pressuring prices, prompting a painful shakeout. Oil companies have laid off an estimated 250,000 workers worldwide. Producers, but, well, you see, unemployment and price fall and a general overproduction crisis worldwide. Chinese steel is more or less enough for the planet. So Italian steel factories are closing. German steel factories are not closing, but they will. And what about corn and oat and wheat and agricultural products in general? Why Bayer and Monsanto have decided this fusion? Well, because the prices of agricultural products have halved during the last 2 years. So we are facing the most huge overproduction crisis of the human history, and we try not to take note of that, except Larry Summers, for instance, who said, reading the Foreign Affairs of March, April, the title was Surviving Low Growth, if I remember well, he speaks of secular stagnation. Deflation, the Japanese situation is becoming the direction of the world. And also, I read an interesting quote for you, taking from the Foreign Affairs, once more. I make good lecture, good readings, you know. And Learning to Love Stagnation by Zachary Carabel, who says the McKinsey Global Institute recently estimated that robots could perform as much as 45% of all the tasks currently carried out by human workers, representing as much as $2 trillion worth of annual wages. But by making manufacturing more efficient, technology is also driving down the cost of almost every good in the world, from hamburgers to automobiles. Really? 45% of jobs could be canceled tomorrow morning? Bad news. Bad news. Are you crazy? What are you talking about? This is the point. This is why we have to think with two different brains. We are witnessing, we are facing the most beautiful, the most rich, the most interesting, the most prosperous situation ever. We are facing the possibility of reducing the labor time of the 45%. We are facing the possibility of stopping producing coal, steel, oil, and so on and so on. Not because we have become ascetic, how do you say that, ascetic, non-consumers, but because we have too much of that shit in our stores. We don't need to work anymore. This is the good news. But we are mistaking this as a frightening, darkening news. That is the point. I think that we should change our epistemological frame in front of the historical process. We should stop thinking about a revolution or reaction, about progress or regression. We should think in terms of gestalt and tangle. The real problem is that our perception of the world, the gestalt that is shaping our vision of things, is totally misleading us. We see fear and misery and unemployment where we should see freedom, emancipation, richness. You know, this is the most interesting situation from the point of view of the possible emancipation of human life from the slavery of the economy that we have ever possibly imagined. But we mistake it because we are unable to come out from the, let's say, the world, from the capitalist gestalt. And the capitalist gestalt has become a tangle. I think that Gregory Bateson is the philosopher that we should read. Stop reading Marx or Larry Summers. Start reading Gregory Bateson because the real point is there. The real problem is a problem of ecology of mind, is a problem of ecology of perception, is a problem of ecology of projection, of social and political projection of the world. So what's going to happen in Europe next? You know, I think that Europe is seriously out of the picture. I don't even care. 10 years ago, in 2005, I thought with Tony Negri and Danny Cohn-Bendit that we had to save Europe. Now I say Europe. I don't want to think in terms of European Union. It's dead, and we have to start thinking about saving not the institution, not the political form. We have to save the real body of Europe, and the real body of Europe is millions of intellectual workers, is millions of cognitive workers who have not been destroyed, who still are there, still studying engineering and poetry and economy and philosophy and many interesting things. This is the starting point of a possible future. Not probable, I know, but possible. The possibility is there. The possibility still is there in the relation between knowledge, technology, and social potency. Potency. That is the difficult word, because I said probable future. Possible future. What is the possible future? Or better, the possible futures. The possibility is never one. The possibility is always plural. The possible future is, in those words of Zachary Carabel, 45% jobs. Tomorrow, cancel. This is the possibility. But the possibility has also to be that we do not depend on work in order to live. Salary is the superstition that is obliging us to think in terms of work. Work is no more necessary. Salary is better. Revenue is better. Food and house and love. This is what we need. Not salary, not work. You know, I think that we have to go through this night. The night is here already, and we cannot skip it. But we have to go through this night, one, deciding that we want to survive, first of all. So I am not so favorable to the idea of taking part of the coming global civil war. I think that we have to be the minority of people who refuse to be taken into the trap of identity, also of leftist identity. I do not want to restage the anti-fascist war. I want to go away. I want to survive. Second, I think that we have to cultivate the only force that can disentangle the possibility. That only force is us, the cognitive workers of the world. Thank you very much.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Franco. That was an incredible talk and some really wonderful things for us to discuss. And the hopeful note that you ended on with respect to the cognitive workers, in return to what you talk about in Spain, about how there are these assemblies these days and wonderful bottom-up forms of decision-making that are happening there. And I'm interested if you to hear more about why you think maybe that's happening so well and so much in Spain, but perhaps did not happen so much in Greece or elsewhere, and what might be needed to make that more of a phenomenon that happens in many places in Europe.
Well, sometimes historical events are beyond explanation. How do you explain that Spain has been in 1936-39 the place where the coming World War has been, in a sense, anticipated and staged in anticipation? And how do we explain that after some decades of fascism, Spain has come out as the country where the autonomies of the cities have been able to reactivate a form of democracy that is certainly at the highest levels in the world. An interesting thing in Spain is the strength of the local autonomies. Mm-hmm. The regions, the city has been a place of survival during the Franco era, and now the city is a place of social autonomy. I mean, how can you explain that 43%, according to the last figures, 43% of people under 35 years are unemployed in Spain? But you know, you don't perceive this. In Italy, everybody is depressed. In France, more than so. In United Kingdom, forget about it. They have always been depressed. And in Spain, you feel the impression that depression is not there. You say, the sun. No, it's not so, because the sun is... we have sun also in Italy.
Indeed.
No, I think that the importance of the local autonomy has been the factor of revitalization. Then you have had the acampada. Mm-hmm. 6 million people in the streets for 1 month.
Right.
It has been an extraordinary experience of daily democracy, but also of creation of the social relations, social affection, which explains the creation of Podemos and so on. I am not so triumphalistic about Podemos. I don't think that they will really win or something. The real thing in Spain is the citizen autonomy. That is the point.
Let's thank him for an amazing conversation and discussion today.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by media activist and philosopher Franco Bifo Berardi titled In the European Night, Will the Union Survive? Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. Our moderator was Wellesley College Assistant Professor of Cinema and Media Studies, Nicholas Knuth. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarson. Thanks for joining us.